Hello and welcome to Gamification Unlocked, a show about real games and how we can use their techniques for learning and change. I'm Brandon Carper, a training designer.
I'm Chad Hafley. I do user experience and web stuff for academic libraries.
And today we're going to talk about video game heroes. So my question for you, Chad, is which video game heroes did you play as a child in video games, and which ones did you particularly identify with?
Well, the first hero I ever played a game as was almost certainly Pac-Man, I think, which there's not a huge amount to identify with there. I mean, I eat things. He eats things.
Okay, let's... anthropomorphic video game hero.
All right, narrowing it down. Okay. The first anthropomorphic video game hero I played as would have been Mario, of course, as I'm sure is the case with many of us. But as far as which ones I identified with most as a child, I was thinking about that in advance of this episode, and I came to the weird conclusion that it was all of the silent ones, and I don't know what that says about me.
Okay, so for example?
For example, Chrono and Chrono Trigger. In role-playing game, Chrono never says a single word. All of the other characters around him, he's the main character you control, and there's other characters in your party of adventurers who say a lot of things, but Chrono himself never actually speaks a single word in it.
Right, and presumably that's so you can more easily project yourself onto that character, I imagine.
Correct.
Yeah.
Similarly, was the protagonist in Secret of Mana also silent? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. Yes, he was.
Yeah, they're similar games in a lot of ways, but another role-playing game. But those were the ones who I think the characters have stayed with me the most, as opposed to, you know, like Master Chief in the Halo games. I enjoyed those games, I had fun with them, but I never particularly identified with him.
Not a lot in common with a space marine that had a lady traveling around inside of the back of his head.
No, not usually.
Yeah, for me, I think Legend of Zelda was one of the first, modern games that I played. And I even remember dressing up as Link one year for Halloween. I know, wasn't I adorable?
Yeah.
Of course, no one knew who I was. So,
hey, it's Green Kid.
Yes. So that was a bit awkward.
Or even if they did, they probably called you Zelda.
Yeah, there is also that. It was hard playing video games in the mid-80s when no one knew what they were.
We were trendsetters.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so kind of a follow-up to that question is about the mentor figures in those video games. So, in Legend of Zelda, the very first one, the first screen has a cave that you go into, and there is an old man in a robe and a white beard. And he says, it's dangerous to go alone. Take this. And he gives you a sword. And then he just pops up every now and then, if you find the right room, to give you these very cryptic, poorly worded hints. And everything else you have to figure out on your own. So
you could steal from him, couldn't you?
What's that?
Wouldn't you steal from him, and then, like, he would kill you with fireballs?
That was in, I think, the Game Boy version.
Oh, okay. For some reason, that's what I remember about this series.
You could also, I think, attack him with your sword, and if you did that too often, he would shoot fireballs at you.
Well, that's just realistic, honestly.
Yeah. So you mentioned Chrono Trigger, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember kind of who was your guide or your mentor in those
I'm
going
to forget his name, but it started with a B, and he kind of lived at the end of time.
Balthazar? Balthazar, right, because there are the three wise men. I remember.
And they're probably the closest thing to a mentor. Like, you know, they understand the mysterious ways of time and teach you a little bit about how time travel works and the mechanics of the game.
Right. Yeah, so in that game, you kind of go as far as you can on your own, and you make some mistakes, and then eventually you get to the old guy at the end. Literally, it's called the end of time.
Yeah.
And he reveals to you how everything works, and then he finally gives you some guidance now that you've exhausted all of your other possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What a great game.
Yep, I'm going to have to go play it. BRB.
So then, yeah, so now that we've thought about our video game heroes and mentors, did we grow up acting like those heroes, and did we end up treating our mentor figures in the same way. I know at least, so personally, Link in Legend of Zelda is a very solitary hero, right? He collaborates with nobody.
Yeah.
And the only interaction he has with those mentor figures is to get some hints now and then, usually after he's already tried something and he's been in the dungeon for a while and he just needs a hint here and there. And I think that that is often how I approach learning still as an adult. So we've talked about, I think, our efforts at trying to learn computer programming here.
My mind is ahead of you, yes.
Right. So I think when I first started to learn computer programming, I kind of approached it like I did Legend of Zelda, where it was just this huge world that I tried to explore on my own. And I only really turned to a mentor figure for help when I got really stuck and I lost a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that I think there's been other examples in my life of that as well. And I don't know, I wonder if my development was kind of shaped by those early games and how the hero acted and how the mentor figures were portrayed, or if it's entirely coincidence and I'm making something up to give a nice intro to this episode.
Well, if you are, my experience mirrors that pretty much. I mean, anytime I try to learn something new, it's stumbling around on my own for a while, doing as much as I can or can't, and then and only then turning to, you know, someone in a position of more knowledge than me.
Right. So I wonder, you know, children growing up today where the games have much better tutorials and
oh man, that's a great question.
Usually a more structured mentor experience. I wonder if when they reach our age, if they'll try to learn things in the same inefficient way we did, or if they'll naturally seek out people who know what they're doing.
Check back in 25 to 30 years for our anniversary episode where we revisit this.
Yeah, speaking of longitudinal studies.
Yeah.
I guess we were speaking about them 2 weeks ago, but yep. Anyway. So, right, so we're asking these questions today because we're going to talk about how the character you play in a game and the teachers you meet in a game can affect you as a person or help you learn better. And the roots and the research of this come from social cognitive theory or social learning theory, which comes from the same Albert Bandura that we talked about a couple weeks ago for self-efficacy.
He's a popular guy.
Yeah, I wasn't even planning that. I was researching this episode and I'm like, no way, Albert. Is this you? Is this you again? And
it's like running into an old friend.
And it was. He was everywhere. So basically, social cognitive theory says that we learn by watching others, which, like a lot of things, it turns out on this show when we first say them, sounds very obvious, and we don't need an expert to tell us this.
But it's confirmed, at least.
Right. But the one of the key aspects of this theory was that we learn not only how to do something, but what will happen to us if we do it. So not only the actual tasks involved in a process, but then the consequences to us and the context that surround that. So if you think back to a teacher or maybe some authority figure, I'm sure you've heard the phrase making an example of someone.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, so, generally it's not a good thing.
Right. Generally not a good thing. I'm sure there's a Game of Thrones example I could think of.
pretty much any scene at random from the show or chapter from the book.
Sure. But the idea there is you punish some prominent leader in a group, and then everyone else in the group watch that person. And it's not only the cognitive aspect of what led to the punishment, but also the emotional contextual impact of seeing someone for their group have a consequence. And then so everyone else learns that vicariously, and they don't have to go through the same experience necessarily to learn the same lesson.
Yep, they can learn from the pain of whatever Game of Thrones character is being killed off that week.
Sure. On the nicer side, as teachers, we're told to praise the students or the learners who do well, so other people will follow suit. So one thing that I was often told to do as a teacher is, you know, if your class is misbehaving, find someone who's doing things right or behaving and publicly praise that person to the rest of the class and say how well they're doing, and other people will follow suit. And that's supposed to be more effective than making a negative example of someone.
Despite being highly embarrassing to the person being praised.
Well, right. A lot of my teaching advice, I think, came from people who were more from a middle school or elementary school background. And I think it's more effective there, and less so when people kind of know what you're up to and you have to be more more subtle.
I'm on to you.
So let's look at how this applies to learning, not from actual people, but from people in video games, specifically people that we inhabit as avatars. So we're going to be using the word avatar as some person you inhabit in a virtual space, like Chrono from Chrono Trigger, or Link, or maybe a person in Second Life or World of Warcraft. We're going to look at how we feel about ourselves and the characters we inhabit, and then how we react to mentors and teacher figures in a virtual environment. So one of the key aspects of how we feel about our avatars is that we tend to feel more positively toward people who resemble the people we inhabit. So basically,
confirmation bias of a sort.
Well, actually, if you put yourself in an avatar in a virtual world, even if that person's different from you, you will end up feeling more positively toward that person.
Ah, okay, I see.
Yeah. So kind of the other way around. Mm-hmm. So that's similar to, if you remember, the political polling experiment that we talked about way back in episode 1 or 2, mm-hmm. about the idea that if you took someone's perspective, in that case it was transgenderism, if you took someone's perspective on that transgender person, you would feel more sympathetic toward that person. In that case, it was, I think, by imaginatively putting yourself in that person's shoes. But the studies that we're going to look at here talk about actually going into a virtual environment. And a lot of these experiments involve actually putting on a VR headset and then turning around and looking in a mirror and then seeing the face that the the scientist has given you for this experiment.
Oh, wow. Like, as a surprise, you don't know in advance?
I don't know. I don't know exactly what disclosures they were given, but it might have been a surprise.
I imagine it probably was, experimentally.
Yeah. So one study, a lot of these studies were done by a guy named Nick Yee. One was done in 2006, where people were given an elderly avatar in a virtual reality environment. And after they kind of looked at themselves in the mirror and they inhabited that world for a while, they ran some tests on them afterward, and one was a word association test, and they were more likely to associate positive words with the elderly than people who did not have an elderly avatar for the experiment.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think so, and it's very heartening. But then I read some follow-up studies. There was one by Victoria Groom in 2009 who tried to see if there would be similar effects on race. So people were given either black avatars or white avatars. And the people given black avatars are actually more likely to associate negative words with black people.
Oof. Ouch.
Than the people not. So in this case, the perspective-taking theory did not hold true. The opposing theory, the stereotype activation theory, they called it, was the hypothesis that won the day, where inhabiting someone from a person you had negative feelings about through stereotypes that actually just activated the negative feelings you already had.
Did the previous study by Nikki mention what race they used as the avatar?
I believe it was Caucasian.
Everybody had the same one.
Right. I believe in most of these studies, they tried to control for racial variables by just making everybody Caucasian. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the 2009 experiment was kind of an unfortunate result. And maybe there's a similar effect there to the political polling experiment, where people were more likely to change their perspective on transgender folks because that was maybe a newer issue that their thoughts hadn't crystallized on yet, where when they got to talking about abortion, they were much less likely to have any change in attitude because they had stronger held feelings about that.
They had felt they had no room for flexibility.
Yeah, maybe. So, yeah, definitely an interesting field to explore. But, you know, as we were talking about the strength of single studies and, you know, the necessity for meta studies in a couple episodes ago, it's probably something we want to, you know, do some more research on before we build any extensive practice based on mm-hmm. it. One interesting thing from Groom's experiment, also kind of independent of the negative or positive associations, was that the people who went into the VR experiment as compared to the people who just did an imaginary exercise had a greater attitudinal shift. So actually being in that virtual reality environment, inhabiting that avatar, had a much greater impact on them than people who just imagined it as requested by the proctor.
So in this case, it was a much greater negative reaction, right?
Probably. I don't know if that's, I guess, strictly scientifically speaking in terms of value accurate, but the conclusion they reached, was a greater mm-hmm. attitudinal shift in some direction. And that's similar to a study in 2015 by Dana Ruggiero. So this was a study on students playing a game called Spent. This was a game about staving off homelessness. You can actually go play it still online, or at least I was able to a few weeks ago.
It's entirely browser-based, if I remember right.
Yeah. Yeah, you're basically put in a position of someone who is about to go bankrupt, and you have a child, and you have a low-paying job, and every day you're faced with choices like your child is sick, do you stay home and take care of your child and risk getting a reprimand at work, or do you go to work and leave your child sick at home and maybe your child gets more sick?
You know what I'm just drawing a connection to now that probably should have been obvious earlier? That's pretty much the post-level screen in Papers, Please. Where you have a certain amount of money and have to decide whether to buy medicine for your children or pay the heating bill.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I hadn't made that connection. That's a good point. I think the difference in Spent is there's more variety to the bad things. I think another one is that eventually you get a toothache and you have to decide whether you pay a lot of money to take care of your toothache up front or if you just let it go and hope it doesn't abscess.
Yeah. And then the way the game's constructed is down the line you'll find out if you do get an abscess.
Right. So it's not a virtual reality environment, but it's definitely putting yourself in the, you know, basically, perspective of someone in that hard financial situation. And in this study, they compared students playing that game to students who just read a first person narrative about being homeless. And they found that the students who played the game were more likely to show empathy toward, the homeless. And this, even after a 3-week period, the feelings were stronger among the game playing group than the story reading group. For better or worse, the ability of games to put you in to someone's perspective is more emotionally resonant and effective, it seems, than just imagining it or, you know, reading a story about it.
I like that you've got examples kind of both, you know, what we would consider a positive attitudinal change and a negative, that, you know, it's a tool. You use it wisely.
Yeah. And I think the jury's still out maybe on how to, you know, achieve perspective taking in more difficult situations mm-hmm. like racial relations. So definitely an area of research I'd be interested to read more about. Another effect is that when we're in a virtual environment, we tend to act like the avatar that we're embodying. So we tend to think subconsciously of the stereotypes or the general perception of kind of the body that we're taking and act accordingly. And these tendencies can carry over into face-to-face interactions. And this is called the Proteus effect, which was coined by Nick Yee from an article of the same name published in Human Communication Research in 2007. So the article starts with referencing some previous studies where For example, people wearing black uniforms tended to act more aggressively than subjects in white uniforms.
Man, even these arbitrary distinctions.
Because I guess there's something in our human psyche somewhere that says black is a more aggressive color than white. Another study, people were told to dress up wearing KKK robes. Wow. And nurse uniforms and deliver shocks as punishment to, willing participants. And I feel like these deliver shock studies at some point were were maybe toned down. I don't know if this was before or because there was the more famous shock study, right, about how willing people were to listen to authority.
Yeah, and basically the answer was too all much. Of it.
Yeah. But anyway, the people in the KKK robes were willing to deliver longer shocks as punishment than people dressed in the nurse uniforms.
That's a weird experimental setup, but okay.
Right. Well, I guess to prove the hypothesis that when you dress up as something else, you're likely to act the way that you've dressed up. And there's some more interesting research here relating to how much your individual identity is taken away. The idea being that when your individuality is taken away, you tend to latch on to some type of group that is given to you, such as a uniform. And there, that plays into theories on mob mentality and so on. But anyway, getting back to virtual reality environments. So in the study of the Proteus Effect article, people given attractive avatars in a virtual reality environment were more likely to stand closer to other people in the virtual reality environment and talk more about themselves.
Wow, okay.
So just like in the experiment with the elderly avatars, these people were told to turn around and look in a mirror, and some people were given an attractive face, and some people were given a less attractive face. Yeah, and the people given more attractive avatars tended to act in a way that we typically expect more attractive people to act, more friendly, more personable, more extroverted.
Yeah, so they inhabited that role very quickly.
Yeah. And then people given taller avatars were more likely to make aggressive negotiations. So they gave people avatars of differing heights. And the people with the taller avatars are more likely to demand a greater stake in a negotiation experiment later on.
So I should wear platform shoes next time I'm negotiating my salary?
No, you should pretend that you're wearing...
Right, okay, right, it's all in my head. Yep.
That's all in your head. So that experiment in 2007 was just in the virtual reality environment, and then Nikki performed a follow-up study in 2009 to see what would happen in a face-to-face environment after the virtual experience. And he confirmed that the people given taller avatars did continue to conduct more aggressive negotiations and face-to-face interviews. Although the effect faded during the experiment, so they were more aggressive at the beginning of the interview and less aggressive toward the end of the interview. But nevertheless, there was some effect from just a small experience as a tall person. So, all right, so there's the empathy aspect of avatars. There's the fact that generally, we're drawn toward our avatars as far as empathy goes. There's the fact that we're drawn toward our avatars as far as, the expectations we have of the avatars we start to apply to ourselves. But then people have also done studies about avatars that look similar to us. So what happens when we see someone who is not different from us, but is similar to how we actually look? There was a study by Jesse Fox, published in Media Psychology in 2009, about weight loss and exercise. And this study showed that people who saw an avatar of themselves gaining or losing weight while they exercised were more likely to continue exercising than people who had a static avatar or no avatar, or people who just basically saw another person doing the exercise.
So it didn't matter whether their avatar gained or lost weight?
Well, basically, depending on the activity that they performed as a person in the experiment, the avatar would gain or lose weight.
Oh, okay. I see. So results reflecting their choices in their avatar.
Right. So they saw themselves and the effects of exercise on themselves in an immediate way in that avatar. And then that kind of carried over into their actual exercising practices later in the real world.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking the question. So lots of interesting experiments in the virtual reality world. And as I was going through these studies, I felt compelled to give a shout out to Jeremy Bailenson, who was the second person listed on the Jesse Fox study, the Victoria Groom study, and all of the Nick Yee studies that I read.
Wow. He's like the power behind the throne on all of these.
Mm-hmm. So keep up the good work, Jeremy. So that's all about our avatars. Now, when we come to the teaching aspect, a lot of this comes from a book that I've referenced previously called Building Expertise by Ruth Colvin Clark. And she calls on-screen teachers learning agents. So as opposed to avatars, these are learning agents. And a lot of her conclusions based on learning agents come from research regarding an e-learning program called Design a Plant, where there's a learning agent called Herman the Bug.
Good old Hermie.
And he was compared against simple text and then a talking head of a young man. And basically the study showed that people learn better when they feel someone is speaking to them in a natural conversational way. So it's good when you're a teacher to talk to people naturally, and it's good when you're designing, you know, e-learning to use informal speech instead of, you know, stilted academic language. And also audio works better than text because I would imagine we're, you know, creatures who, you know, conversation is more natural than reading.
As it's interesting, makes me think of the, so at work we answer reference questions via chat, via IM essentially. Mm-hmm. And as part of my work, I periodically review the transcripts, and there's a distinct difference in how well those interactions play out based on the tone that the librarian takes in that interaction. Whether it's very stilted and informal, like where they could be mistaken for a bot, is much less effective than someone who warms up and, you know, kind of reflects the tone that the question asker has chosen to take. I don't have experimental evidence to back that up or statistics or anything, but anecdotally at least, I can, you know, confirm that that seems to work much better in my experience.
Oh, sure. Well, there's other, I think, areas of psychology that talk about the mirroring effect. Mm-hmm. Right, where people are more likely to relate to you and feel positively if you mirror their own tone and body language and so on.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing that came out of this was that the on-screen learning agent doesn't have to be high fidelity. So basically just the suggestion that there's a human there or some type of person is all that you need. So she gives an example of database training. And database training, a database is typically represented by a cylinder for whatever reason. I don't know how that started, but in any case, in this training, the learning agent is just a cylinder with a face. And that's, you know, sufficient enough to fool the brain into thinking that, you know, a person is actually talking to you.
This is going to sound like a snarky question, but I mean it legitimately. So if something like that can be deemed successful, why didn't Clippy work out better?
You know, I thought a lot about that. You know, I did think about Clippy when I was doing this episode, and maybe mm-hmm. there's probably some deeper research into this that I didn't have time to do. But I imagine a lot of it might have been Clippy popping up unsolicited.
Yeah.
Right.
It looks like you're trying to write a letter.
Right. Maybe if Clippy had popped up when you asked him to, or if the algorithms behind Clippy were slightly more helpful.
My memories of Clippy, which are slightly blurry at this point, are also that he was less instructional and more about doing things for you.
Mm.
And I wonder if that had an impact also.
That's a good point. Did we say who Clippy was? Clippy?
Oh, no. I just assume everyone knows Clippy.
Yeah, so Clippy was, I guess, a learning agent, you would call him, for Microsoft Word 2000?
I was going to guess 03, sometime around then. 03?
Yeah, but he would
probably
pop
97,
up.
I bet you're right.
Yeah, he would pop up out of nowhere, and he would say things like, it looks like you're writing a letter.
And he was an animated paperclip.
Right. and there would be the sound effect when he appeared, like a wishing sound, and he would like tink tink on your screen or something.
Maybe. Yeah, down in the corner, blocking what you were trying to do.
Yeah. And he was reviled.
Generally, still reviled.
Unfortunately. So, yeah, there's probably some deeper research into that. But, I mean, even if Clippy had been a real person popping up, you know, I don't think it was the fact that it was someone... I don't think it was the fact that he was an animated paperclip. I just think that his algorithms and maybe his implementation didn't quite jive with what people needed.
I would say that sounds plausible.
Yeah. One final thing that Ruth Colvin Clark pointed out in her book was that some early studies have shown that just watching a question and answer session between a teacher and a student as a third party can be just as effective at learning something as actually completing an exercise on the material. So let that sink in for a bit.
She, as a completely passive observer.
Yeah, she calls it deep level question answer. So she gives an example where a student's learning something about maybe RAM and computer speed. So, you know, the student says, what is, you know, I heard that I should be installing RAM in my computer. What's RAM? And the teacher says, well, it's something that can help your computer go faster. And the student says, well, what about RAM makes the computer go faster? And the teacher responds. And then maybe the student says something else. So there's like a question and answer dialogue that kind of probes into the why and the how behind the answers. And some early studies show that kind of reading those could be just as effective as actually doing exercises on, you know, say, RAM or computer speed. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. You know, as a trainer, the golden rule is usually always have your students do it instead of just watch.
Yeah.
But there is some early research that shows maybe in some cases it's more efficient just to have them watch, and then the doing parts should be more judiciously parceled out. So, but I mean, that kind of dialogue goes all the way back to Socrates, right? Or at least Plato's interpretation of Socrates, where the entire story was just question and answer.
Yeah, about as old as learning theories go.
Right, right. So, all right, we have all this research on learning agents and avatars. So let's apply them to a game. I thought about what game to apply them to, and I finally just decided to pick a game that I happen to be playing because it just recently came out. Final Fantasy XV. Not a particularly remarkable game, maybe in terms of breaking ground avatar-wise or learning agent-wise, but I thought it'd be interesting just to take a modern AAA title and see what would come out from shining the light of research on it.
Yeah, let's make it a case study.
Did you ever get much into the Final Fantasy series, Chad?
I played 7 extensively, like explored all the weird corners of it. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I never went back to it.
Yeah, so 7, I think, was where a lot of people got into the series. It was the first PlayStation Final mm-hmm. Fantasy game, starring Cloud Strife.
Yes.
As a guy with a lot of hair and a huge sword.
I think it took up like 3 CDs, which at the time was ridiculous.
Oh, that's right. And you had to switch CDs in the middle. Yeah. And I think that was when summoning monsters became obnoxious first in Final Fantasy
games.
Yeah,
there was it the Knights of the Round summoning that I think took upwards of like 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah, you could get abilities that involve summoning monsters. And basically, you summon the monster and you sat back for an extremely long time and waited for them to do their thing.
It was a snack break.
So the series Final Fantasy began in 1987. It was a role-playing game, meaning you basically fight monsters to level up and get better weapons and spells so you can fight bigger monsters.
Which sums up a lot of games when you come down to it.
Yeah, essentially. It's usually set in a fantasy sci-fi world. So for example, the first game was set in a world with you know, swords and magic, but then you got an airship and you went to a castle that levitated above the sky through pseudoscience.
It was a little steampunky before steampunk was a thing.
Right. And various games have been on either end of the fantasy or sci-fi spectrum. So this installment, Final Fantasy XV, was 10 years in the making. You play Prince Noctis, and you're basically on a road trip to your wedding with three of your friends. You have Ignis, who's the brains of the group. You have Gladiolus, the brawn of the group. And you have Propto, who just gives wisecracks and takes selfies and photographs a lot. I've actually laughed out loud a few times at his joke, so I'll admit.
Well, that's an endorsement.
Yeah. So you still go around fighting monsters, but you spend a surprising amount of time talking to people at truck stops.
There's truck stops?
Yeah, yeah. You start the game literally starts with you pushing your broken car down the road until you get to a truck stop. You hold down R2 to push your car.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and you do a lot of camping out in the game as well. So to level up, you have to actually go to sleep. And the game was sponsored by Coleman, actually.
So Chad, like, I saw for real, it's actually Coleman. Sponsored?
Yeah. So there's if you can find a photo from the game, you see there's like four guys walking down the road, and one guy is clearly carrying a fold-out camp chair that has Coleman on it.
Oh, I'm sitting in a Coleman camp chair at the moment as we record.
Yeah, how about that?
I didn't get paid for it, though.
Well, the night is still young.
Yep.
So the tutorial in this game is a little bit weird. You can start the game and choose to do this totally separate tutorial from the main game that just teaches you about the combat, which is a little strange because usually games weave the combat tutorials into the beginning of the game a lot better, or at least more smoothly. And I think from a training perspective, that's usually better because people learn tasks better when they're presented in the context that they'll do them in later, and to have kind of a vacuum where you practice your combat is maybe not quite as effective.
Yeah, I think we talked about this previously with like Hearthstone and some other examples. Yeah, where it gave you a card like in a practice mode at the exact time you would need it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So it didn't take you to a totally weird white room that said, here is a card that does the thing. Yeah, it actually had you do it in an actual game. Yeah, exactly right. So the tutorial here is a bit weird, but it did have a learning agent here in the form of basically an albino magical fennec fox called Carbuncle.
Carbuncle.
Communicates. Okay. Yeah. He communicates to you via text message.
I'm going down the rabbit hole here, okay.
Yeah, well, you're not actual text messages, but your phone in the game. And basically he tells you what to do. Whenever you do something right, he'll send you an emoji, like a party hat when you do something right, or my favorite and Hannah's favorite were maracas.
Nice.
So yeah, that was probably, helpful as far as learning agents and the research goes. Another example, not from Final Fantasy, but from a series called Disgaea. In that series, you play as Valvatores, Disgaea 4, that is. You play as Valvatores, who is basically a vampire training the Legions of Hell. And the beginning of the game is you training basically these penguins how to fight. Just go with it.
I'm with you, yeah.
So in that case, Valvatores himself is the learning agent, is the teacher, and the penguins ask questions now and then about why you should do a certain thing, or why you should move to the square, or why you can't just keep attacking, and so on, and Valvatores will give the answer. So instead of forcing you to kind of discover those things through trial and error, or make you do an exercise for each thing, there's kind of a question and answer Socratic dialogue between the vampire and the penguins in hell.
So. Well, it's nice to see even the Legions of Hell can base their methodologies on research.
Right. Well, it pays to, keep up with training design theory.
Efficiency is efficiency.
So as far as, the avatars go, you do play the game in third person, so you don't inhabit Noctis from a first person point of view. So it probably has a stronger effect on your behavior, whatever effect it has, than if it were a first-person game. But you cannot choose what your avatar looks like, and you can't even choose which character to play. So in older Final Fantasies, like Final Fantasy VII, for example, you could pick from a wide variety of cast members to play.
Yeah, I remember extensively crafting my party at any given moment, which people I wanted with me for their various skills.
Right, right. So here, not the case. You're just controlling Noctis all the time, which is different from a lot of modern AAA games. I guess these are mostly Western, like the Elder Scrolls with Skyrim or Oblivion, or like Dark Souls, where you can just intricately craft your character at the very beginning to, you know, make their cheekbones in the exact right spot, or the distance between their mouth and their chin, and so on. If you'd like to see just how detailed these systems are, you can Google a YouTube series called Monster Factory, where some people from Polygon take these systems to the extreme.
Oh, I think I'm going to lose the rest of my evening afterward to that.
Oh, this evening and probably several other evenings. Yeah.
And aren't there some of the, like, the modern sports games will actually take your picture and then, like, craft a player that looks like you, more or less?
Yeah, I think they did one of those once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to varying degrees of success, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also more, you know, low-fidelity versions of this. So in Stardew Valley, you play a farmer, and you can change their gender and their hair and their skin color, and it's all just a simple sprite, but, you know, going on the same theory of you can pretend that a cylinder with a mouth is a human, you can probably get the same effect from, you know, just a suggestion that your avatar is like you, as you would from the high fidelity representations in Elder Scrolls and Dark Souls.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, but in Final Fantasy 15, you just get Noctis. He's basically a teenage, maybe early 20s, white or Japanese male. And so in light of that Jesse Fox study that says you're more likely to get behavior change from an avatar that looks like you, you're probably not going to get a lot of, you know, behavioral effect from, you know, seeing yourself as Noctis unless you are, in fact, someone who looks like Noctis.
Which may be a significant population of gamers.
That's true. That's true. And then as far as, you know, inhabiting another character to maybe develop empathy for them, like in Nikki's studies, since you're only inhabiting Noctis for, you know, the entire game, you're probably less likely to establish sympathy for people from different backgrounds. You know, in Final Fantasy VII, for example, you could not only play as Cloud, but also Barret, a black guy with a machine gun arm, mm-hmm. who had probably problematic racial things going on for other reasons.
Yeah, it's probably best I don't go back and replay that now.
You could play as Aeris or Tifa, who are the girls in the group. You could play as a cat riding a large white monster being radio controlled by a guy in an office building.
I forgot about that plot development.
If that's a demographic you care about developing empathy for.
It's branching out.
Although as I was going through this, you know, I was wondering, is just putting someone in an avatar of a different race or gender in a game without all of the context that goes along with it, is it really that significant, right?
Like, so you're saying if you could, like, palette swap the skin color of your character in Final Fantasy XV, but no other changes to the game?
Right, so let's say that the study that we looked at from Victoria Groom about, you know, inhabiting an avatar of a different race, let's say it actually did have a positive effect.
Mm-hmm.
If you just put yourself, you know, in a black avatar as a white person in a video game, just totally divorced from, you know, all of the context that surrounds that in America, for example, would that really be a meaningful experience, or would you just be, you know, inhabiting an avatar with a different skin tone? You know what I mean?
Yeah, because the experience doesn't change other than what you see when you look in a mirror.
Right. So, you know, as a minority group, right, there's a lot of, you know, social, economic problems that go along with that. And if you're not really playing an avatar that is having to deal with those problems, or where those problems affect you in the game, you know, I wonder, like, how effective it is just to play someone that is, you know, just physically resembling someone from that group.
Yeah, if there's no impact on the gameplay or the way you proceed through the game world, then it almost doesn't even matter what your character looks like.
Yeah, you know, I wonder. you know, the studies we looked at were just based on pure physical appearance. Yeah. But, mm-hmm. you know, social context, how much of an impact would that have in a virtual environment? Or even maybe, you know, similar clothing to indicate socioeconomic status or something.
Mm-hmm.
So fruitful lines for further research, says yeah, the definitely. Person who does not do academic research person.
Yeah, but we can plant some seeds.
Then as far as, you know, conforming to the expectations you have as your avatar, and this plays, you know, back into, is it just physical appearance that matters, or also kind of the context? But in the game, you play as a prince with magical powers who can go wherever he wants in the open world. And the combat is interesting because you don't control your friends directly. And I think most every Final Fantasy game up until this point, you can actually kind of, like we were saying, inhabit your other friends periodically. So you actually play those people. Here, you don't actually play those other characters. You just give them orders.
And they just follow you blindly.
Yeah, and they just follow you immediately. And sometimes your friends will save you from being knocked down by monsters. And sometimes when you're closer to your friends and you attack a monster, your friends will, you know, kind of gang up on the monster with you. So, you know, I wonder, so you play this game and eventually you come to see Noctis as somebody who relies on his friends a bit, but can also give his friends orders, basically, and they respond to him immediately, blindly. And, you know, I wonder what kind of effect that would have, you know, after playing this game for 60 hours as, you know, maybe a child or an elementary schooler who has kind of more of that, you know, plastic, flexible brain, you know, what kind of effect that has.
On expectations of friendship and interacting with peers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, maybe it would be positive because you're, you know, collaborating with people in a way that maybe isn't typically presented in an RPG because they're presented as separate people that you don't control. Maybe slightly negative because, you know, you're giving orders and everyone's there to serve you, you know?
Yeah, you can just boss everyone around.
So, and yeah, that's probably going further afield from the impact of the avatar into the actual, you know, training and behavioral conditioning part of it. But
I think it's all tied up together, though.
Yeah. Interesting questions to ask, I think. So I think some takeaways then from our little dive into this research is that if you're a trainer and you have kind of an effective goal, an emotional goal, maybe you're delivering training on company culture, for example, maybe consider creating an avatar that resembles someone you want the learner to feel positively toward, like a customer. So maybe have them inhabit a customer's shoes for a while. Because, you know, these studies so far have shown that inhabiting someone else's shoes generally can make you take on more positive feelings toward that person.
So with that method, you would advocate or at least say explore the option of going through training as not the employee?
Well, maybe one part of it is, so maybe you're doing retail training. Maybe you're training managers of a retail establishment, right? And you really want them to feel some empathy for the customer or do things with the customer's best interests in mind. And instead of just giving them a list of rules, you really want them to take that mindset, right? And mm-hmm. take it to heart. So maybe in the training, you present them as a customer going into maybe a retail store where things are not carried out as well as they could be, and maybe have them experience frustration as they're trying to, you know, get things done or just buy the book they want. I'm sorry, bookstores don't exist as much anymore. buy the jeans they want, or, you know, order the food they want, or find a clean table or something like that.
So it lets them see the impact of decisions that they might make as an employee.
Right. And, you know, theoretically then once they, you know, get out of that training, they would feel more empathy toward, you know, people who are in those shoes, and you know, maybe
I could see that working.
Yeah. Now, if you have more of a, you know, a standard behavioral goal where you have something specific you want people to do, which, you know, is more typical of training, maybe allow people just to choose an avatar that resembles them, and, you know, show the effects of what they do on that avatar. So maybe if you're doing customer service training, which is, you know, a nice standby to come to for an example. You know, maybe if they make the wrong choice on the phone, you can show their avatar looking a bit disheartened or discouraged. And if that avatar looks like them, you know, based on the research that we talked about, they'll be more likely to take that to heart, because they'll think if they do that wrong behavior, then they'll also feel similarly disheartened or sad.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these don't have to be, you know, high fidelity representations. Even if you're just doing like a teacher and student conversation, you can use kind of those low fidelity avatars that we talked about going through the Socratic dialogues.
So maybe we can redeem Clippy.
Well, some things, Chad, there's no coming back from, unfortunately.
2.0.
But, well, thank you for joining us on this journey through the virtual worlds of avatars and learning agents and Final Fantasy 15. You've been listening to Gamification Unlocked. I'm Brandon Carper.
And I'm Chad Haefeli.
If you have not done so already, find us on Twitter. You can find us at Unlocking Games, and I believe you can find Chad at Hidden Peanuts.
Correct.
And you can find me at Brandon Plus Game. So if you'd like to get a more stream of consciousness view into our thoughts and lives, feel free to follow us on there and get updates on new episodes and content. Speaking of which, we're going to be taking just a brief hiatus from the show. So this show is going out on Thursday, January 5th, and we're going to be back on January 19th with a slightly new format and a new focus. So that is something you have to look forward to in the cold early weeks of January 2017. Until then, it's your move.